I think in some ways, this whole discussion over Christian nationalism could be settled by a simple verse from the Bible. Jesus himself said, "My kingdom is not of this world." And that should settle the discussion.
One would think so, Dr. Balmer. One would think so.
And in their final memorial, they insisted, and I quote here, "We are fully persuaded of the happy influence of Christianity upon the morals of men, but we have never known it in the history of its progress so effectual for this purpose as when left to its native excellence and evidence to recommend it under all the directing providence of God and free from the intrusive hand of the civil magistrate." The church does best when it's allowed to be the church and preach the gospel, because they thought the intrinsic truthiness, to quote Colbert, right? The truthiness of the gospel is when people can really hear it, it is compelling. And that's how God changes people's hearts. In a couple of their memorials, they point back, they note that Jesus did not depend upon the power of the state to advance his kingdom.
Keeping it simple, the first speaker was Randall Balmer, John Phillips Chair in Religion at Dartmouth College. Then Paul Kemeny, Dean of Arts and Letters at Grove City College, read from the final memorial written by the leaders of the Hanover Presbytery in 1785 to the Virginia legislature in opposition to a statute which would fund clergy with taxpayer funding. The Hanover Presbyterians, along with the Baptists and many other Virginia citizens, expressed their opposition to the bill and in support for full religious freedom. The Presbyterians came to believe that the intrusive hand of the civil magistrate was detrimental to progress of Christianity. They had not lost faith in the positive influence of Christianity, but they believed the church and virtue prospered best when unaided by the state. Both scholars remind us that the work of the church is to build the kingdom of God. As John Foreman sang, "I pledge allegiance to a country without borders." Christian nationalism operates on a different principle. The Christian nationalist sees immorality in society and concludes that the church does not provide sufficient moral witness. Surely, if sin is happening, something must be done, and the state alone has sufficient power to coerce righteousness. Certainly, the church and state need each other. You know, that sounds familiar. Dr. Kemeny, has that been tried before?
In the West, since the Constantinian arrangement, where there's a state-sanctioned church, which comes in a variety of different iterations with all kind of nuances and complexities over the previous 1,000 years. But in the West, there's always, you know, since the 4th, 5th century, been some sort of state-sanctioned church, sometimes strong, sometimes not very strong. But the logic in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century was largely that a republican form of government needs virtuous citizens. The second premise is that religion produces virtuous citizens, right? The welfare of society is dependent upon the virtue of the people. Those two premises were taken for granted. And if we fashion this into a simple syllogism, the conclusion had been, if the republican form of government needs virtuous citizens, religion produces virtuous citizens, therefore the state should preserve the established church because it helps produce virtuous citizens.
I knew it. We've been down this road before. However, there is, and has always been, a catch. The system was supposed to produce virtuous citizens, but instead it led to war and persecution. In the last episode of this series, I discussed state-sponsored violence toward citizens in modern nations of Uganda and Pakistan. The founders were aware of religious violence in their history and wanted to avoid it in the new United States. Listen to this dramatic reading of Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia from the Monticello website.
"Is uniformity attainable? Millions of innocent men, women, and children since the introduction of Christianity have been burnt, tortured, fined, imprisoned, yet we have not advanced one inch towards uniformity. What has been the effect of coercion? To make one half the world fools and the other half hypocrites, to support roguery and error all over the earth.
In Virginia, Madison and Jefferson were moved by the religious persecution they saw, which motivated Jefferson to write the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, eventually passed through the Virginia legislature with Madison's political stewardship in 1786. Even before Virginia's crucial statute, there was Roger Williams in Rhode Island. We will hear more about that later in this segment. Separation of church and state is an innovation of the American experiment, no matter what David Barton and the Christian Nationalists tell you. Throughout this series, I hope I have provided sufficient evidence to demonstrate that Christian nationalism is based on faulty history. In the last episode, I focused on some of the negative political consequences of Christian nationalism. In this episode, I want to examine negative religious consequences of Christian nationalism. Said differently, I want to show that Christian nationalism is bad Christianity. I'm Warren Throckmorton, and along with Michael Coulter wrote Getting Jefferson Right, Fact-Checking Claims About Thomas Jefferson. You're listening to the podcast series Telling Jefferson Lies, a story about how history can be hijacked for ideological and political purposes. In previous episodes, we told the story of how David Barton's best-selling book about Thomas Jefferson was removed from publication in 2012 due to historical errors. Today, I examine the negative impact of Christian nationalism on Christianity. We are working our way toward the series finale and a celebration of the virtues of the separation of church and state. This is episode 12, Losing Our Religion. 3 o'clock and cloudy, bars are open down on Rivington Street. No call, no show to work today. Wondering if this girl can get something to eat. Well, the job just took the breath from him, and the paycheck never sat too tall. Wants to give that girl the best he's got, 'cause the world awaits us all. Before I proceed, I want to acknowledge that those who are attracted to Christian nationalism are often sincere in their religious and patriotic aspirations. They want the best for the nation and their communities. They see aspects of Christian nationalism as possible solutions to what they experience as difficult problems in the culture and their communities. I think many people sincerely attracted to Christian nationalism are trying to fix problems they see in the world. I think many people attracted to Christian nationalist ideas are feeling threatened by social change.
Barton knows that telling his story is connecting with something people on a gut level. And he's aware of something at a gut level. He's meeting a need, right? He's telling a story that people want to hear. Okay. And the fact that people persist in that story means that there are people who are unhappy with the way the world has changed and don't know what to do. And when that happens, you'd like someone to tell you a story that reassures you. And we probably have not delved deeply enough into that to say, what is it driving this? What is it that makes people, or I'm a reporter, I might be wondering, why do people hate the changes in America so much? They're very disruptive. And I don't know if we pay attention. And maybe Barton's persistence tells us something about the story people want to be true and the scope of the changes.
That was Religion News Service journalist Bob Smetana. I think Bob is probably correct. Barton's appeal may relate to his ability to tap into whatever discontent people feel. The white nationalist element of Christian nationalism is harder to deal with. While fear and threat may also be at the root, one cannot tolerate racism. We are at a difficult place in our society with white replacement theory animating one of the major political parties.
Well, President Trump said it explicitly. He said, well, why are we allowing so many people in from what he called these shithole countries, Africa? And why not more people from Norway? He said, wouldn't that be good? We should have more people from Norway. Well, you know, you can't telegraph it any more clearly than that. And they've already lost in a way, and that even makes them angrier. I think that's the thing. So holding on to power when you have already, in a sense, lost a lot of ground is tough. You need transgender people or some other issue to kind of reinvigorate enough people to keep in power. But you have, once the United States began to change demographically in a way that cannot be reversed, and I would say the 1965 Immigration Act is the key moment in our history. And a lot of people don't really think of that as so important or even, you know about it, but under Johnson, but actually that changed America. And that is what, and I don't even think people realized at the time, but what it did was it opened the door to all kinds of people who were barred before, or quotas were kept them out. So, you know, Asian people, African people. And, you know, I think America is so much better off, but I don't think these folks see that. They think this is destroying us.
That was historian and First Amendment expert Charles Haynes. He put his finger on one element which is clearly driving much anxiety among many prominent Christian nationalist leaders, including Tucker Carlson, Charlie Kirk, and Matt Walsh. This is one wedge issue the Republican Party hopes to use in the 2024 election to motivate conservative voters to turn out for Donald Trump, who has promised mass deportations if elected. Empirical evidence supports Haynes and Smetana's observations. Two recent studies found that reminders that the number of Christians is declining in the U.S. is associated with negative emotions and higher Christian nationalism scores. One study found higher support for Trump, and another found greater perceptions of persecution among participants who were reminded of declines in Christianity. Fear of losing control may heighten awareness of social changes at odds with traditional Christian moral positions. Christian nationalists often point to what they believe to be moral failings in the United States as justification for degrading the separation of church and state. One Christian nationalist leader tweeted that a system with a state church would be better than the United States because with all of the faults of the state church, quote, it was way better than our current system, 60 million children dead, and drag queens reading to the ones who make it, end quote. Dartmouth College history professor Randall Balmer reminds us that the road to Christian nationalism has been paved with worry about social upheaval since the founding of the nation.
One of the glories of the United States, in my judgment, is that our charter documents have always made provisions for minorities. That is to say, we are not a majoritarian culture or society. The majority cannot impose its will on the minority. Now, we've come very close many times to doing that. And it's also true that we have been slow, far, far too slow to ensure the rights of minorities, particularly people of color and women in our history. But what makes me patriotic as an American is not some sort of flag-waving, red-capped demonstration. It is instead the sense, the assurance that Americans always rise to their better selves. That is, we always live up to or try to live up to the ideals that are encoded into our charter documents.
Balmer provides valuable perspective. The Christian nationalist impulse is old and has persisted alongside a dominant competing drive for religious liberty and freedom of conscience. It's a faulty history that creates the sense that something is now so wrong and so different from the past that we need a strong authoritarian government which will guarantee a Christian society. many Christians feel a sense of loss of a past that never actually existed, and Christian nationalist storytellers like David Barton are in business to heighten that sense of loss. In fact, by many measures, now is the best time to be alive. Besides, for many groups of people, the past wasn't great at all in the United States. For most people in those groups, things are a whole lot better now than ever. It seems like a lot of Christian nationalists forget that America isn't just for or about white men. So it's important to keep that in mind.
I think Christian nationalism started in the Garden of Gethsemane when the mob was coming to take Jesus and Peter reached for his sword. It's a clear example of the difference between cross power and sword power. And Jesus told Peter, put it away. We don't do that here. And then he willfully took on the cross.
That was Caleb Campbell, Phoenix, Arizona pastor and author of an upcoming book on Christian nationalism. He distinguishes between the way of the cross and the way of the sword. Notre Dame history professor emeritus George Marsden argues that the entanglement of the cross and the sword precludes the possibility of a Christian nation.
Nations exist to protect the self-interest of their peoples, and that's a necessary kind of thing and not a, I mean, it's a legitimate kind of arrangement to have nations that, or governments that protect the interests. But given that human nature has fallen, what happens is in nations that even, you know, just about every nation, usually in history, nations have had some sort of religious justification for saying our nation is particularly chosen by God. But the problem is when Christians say that, is that the nation is promoting all sorts of things. One of the things that's endemic to most of human nature is for instance, the basic sin of pride. And people are proud of their nation. They're overly proud of themselves. They think themselves better than other people. There's all sorts of things that are sub-Christian views that the nation promotes, and it promotes them through violence and through the sword, as the Bible says.
Reaching out our hand and taking power as an organization or as a people makes total sense according to the power structures of the kingdoms of this world. What doesn't make any sense, Warren, is taking up our cross unless there's a resurrection. So this, again, I would just encourage anyone who's meditating on how we think about power. The upside down way of Jesus is that a cross actually is more powerful than a sword because there's resurrection on the other side. If there is no resurrection on the other side, pick up the sword. Let's do it, baby.
Even if the cultural intuitions and perceptions of Christian nationalists were accurate, I submit that Christian nationalism represents a flawed remedy. In theological terms, it springs from an attempt to gain salvation by works rather than grace, an attempt to live by the sword as opposed to the cross. And if you live by the sword, what do you die by? In Christian theology, if you live by the cross, you never really die. Christian nationalism is a futile attempt to work out one's own salvation by using political power in the form of government coercion to do the work of the church. In the rest of this segment, I want to describe some of the specific ways Christian nationalism detracts from beneficial religion.
Really know I think the ends justify the means. I mean, this is a movement that's, it's not a dispute over theology. This is not about, you know, what's the proper interpretation of Christianity. This is an organized quest for power. And you can see it in their unwavering support for Donald Trump, who David Barton, in the run-up to the 2016 election, he called Trump God's guy. God's guy.
That was friend of the podcast and author of Power Worshippers, Catherine Stewart. Her critique of Christian nationalism is devastating. She has identified many ways evangelicalism has turned into a political label and become incorporated into the Republican Party. Barton is as good an illustration as any of how quickly political reality trumps moral qualms in the evangelical political world. Before he called Trump God's guy, Barton actually criticized Trump and dismissed him as someone who did not have the moral qualifications to lead. On Michael Brown's radio show, Barton had a truth attack when asked by Brown to compare Trump to Ronald Reagan.
About drawing parallels between Ronald Reagan's ascension and Donald Trump's ascension.
I think it would be a good parallel if Ronald Reagan also had strip clubs, if he also ran casinos, if he also cussed in public, if he also was an admitted serial adulterer, if he also talked about how many women he had slept with, if he also, you know, if Ronald Reagan did all that, it might be a good comparison. But to say that Ronald Reagan was a liberal in his day, that he was twice married, I mean, there is no moral comparison at all. There is no religious comparison at all. Ronald Reagan was one of the most outspoken pro-Bible presidents we've had. We can't even get Trump to be able to know what the second book in the Corinthians series is. And a guy who is, I'm a good Christian, but he's never asked for forgiveness. How do you become a Christian without asking for forgiveness? So those who are making that comparison, I think, now they may support him. That's fine. Welcome to America. Support your candidate. But don't liken Donald Trump and Ronald Reagan. There is absolutely no valid comparison there unless you just want to say he's twice married and Trump is thrice married. All right, maybe that's your comparison.
Right.
That's the best you can do. That's not good.
Yeah, and Ronald Reagan famous for his humility and Donald Trump famously proud of his pride. So,
that's right.
Yeah.
That's a good way. Proud of his pride. That's right.
At the time, Barton was stumping for Ted Cruz and running at least one super PAC for him. However, when it was clear Cruz wasn't going to be the nominee, all of a sudden, Barton changed his tune and Trump was God's guy.
Religious nationalist leaders around the world do. When they're very corrupt and they want to consolidate a more authoritarian form of political power, they bind themselves very tightly to ultra-conservative religious figures. Often they do this in their own countries in order to consolidate that power. And they're surrounded by the holy men. So they say you can't criticize me. I've got Robert Jeffress to my left and I've got Mark Burns to my right, which is what Donald Trump does. And they're bubble wrapping themselves in sanctimony in order to avoid any investigation of their own nepotism and corruption and cronyism and any abuses they may be perpetrating against their own people.
Stewart's indictment of evangelical leaders is a hammer. When she speaks of Trump, she says he bubble wraps himself in sanctimony. I can almost see that. This also put me in mind of the term John Fea coined, court evangelicals.
The court evangelicals are the guys who go to the court, the so-called King's Court, the White House, right? This is drawing upon sort of medieval and Renaissance courtiers, right? People who would go to the king for the sole purpose of telling the king what he wants to hear, flattering the king. A court evangelical never speaks truth to the king, never speaks truth to power. The courtier is there to puff the king up, to make the king feel good, to tell the king what he wants to hear. So I took that sort of medieval Renaissance idea of the courtier, and I applied it to people like Robert Jeffress, Jerry Falwell Jr. Metaxas has been to the White House, so he qualifies. Paula White, Franklin Graham, and so forth. These people who claim the mantle of Christianity, claim the mantle of morality and speaking the truth, right? And then they refuse to call Donald Trump out for things that he does, whether they be tweets or policies or whatever. that are blatantly immoral, right? So, you know, where are the court evangelicals today when Donald Trump is retweeting this crazy doctor who's saying that the coronavirus comes from demon seed, you know, that cap in the middle of the night, you know, where are they? Where are they saying this is wrong? They don't.
The run-up to the 2016 election, I was going to a lot of right-wing conferences and strategy gatherings. I don't think every leader, you know, like, again, you can't know what's in people's hearts, but I don't think every leader of in that movement thought of Trump as their model. You know, I think some of them would have preferred Ted Cruz. But once it was clear that he was going to be the front runner, and he made various deals. I mean, he got together with 1,000 pastors in New York City and said, I'm going to appoint an evangelical council. I'm going to have Mike Pence as my VP. And I'm going to, you know, choose only pro-life judges to appoint to the Supreme Court, et cetera, the other courts. So he did all those things. They're like, okay, he's our guy. And they all got behind him. And they said, there's no victory without unity. And some of them justified it by saying, this election is about judges, judges, judges. So that kind of cynicism, as you can tell, is really, I think, proof that this is a movement that's really about power by any means necessary.
Greg Thornberry, former president of the King's College, was in many of those rooms when those deals were made. He couldn't believe what he was hearing.
I was behind the enemy lines there, you know, and I mean, I had so many revealing conversations. I don't know whether or not to use their names or not, but I was invited to a meeting not related to Trump at the Union League Club, but there were a couple prominent conservative nonprofit leaders at this table. And I will never forget this. They said, for so long, evangelicals have just sort of stayed true to this sort of kind of central kind of, this is what we want out of a candidate, and this is our message, and we keep losing. And it was like the most, it sounded like I was listening to Michel Foucault, because they were like, all that matters is the ability to gain access to power and to discipline and punish our enemies.
So instead of just voting one's values, the worst expression of Christian nationalism is about putting one's thumb on the scale to gain and maintain political power. When the church becomes a political party, it loses what makes it distinctive from any other institution. It loses what it's about, which is finding some understanding of and relationship with God and the greater matters of being. Why are we here and what's our purpose? Surely we aren't here just to win elections. Isn't there something more? Something else? Some greater truth to understand? While we are in the world, Jesus said, we aren't of it. Another result of politicizing religion is that religion becomes a means and not an end. Practically, it means that there aren't many meaningful differences in Christianity because Christ is just a means to political power. Although not within the Christian camp himself, Jonathan Larson says that's how it looks to him.
Really what's at stake here is not some subtle fine points of theology. It's essentially just anti-intellectualism, and it's the exalting of your own instinct. And that can be true both politically and religiously, right? And the Fellowship Foundation makes all kinds of room and allowances for this very unschooled, unthoughtful, unbiblically based version of Christianity that just allows you to do whatever you want to do. One of the things that I did talk about a little bit, but not a lot, was in the same prayer breakfast in Uganda, Museveni actually spoke, and he talked about the Sermon on the Mount, and he talked about, turning the other cheek. And he said, you know, I was part of a Christian group that said, hey, maybe you shouldn't have all those rifles and be killing all those people because our Jesus says to turn the other cheek. And Museveni said, his response was, you know what? I like the being violent in the temple because I don't like having money changers, Jesus, right? So he was able to find something in scripture that justified him being violent towards his enemies. And if Jesus can be violent towards the tables of the money changers, then why can't, you know, Museveni be violent with rifles towards his political enemies? So there's, and the other thing I will note that you can probably testify to more effectively than I can, so please correct me if you think I'm wrong here, but a lot of the people, possibly even a majority of these associates, these self-appointed ministers that the Fellowship Foundation serves as a clearinghouse for, these are not theology students. These are not people who came out of seminary. A lot of them are just business folks who think, you know what, I like the Jesus that I hear about from Doug Coe, so I'm on board with that, and I'll learn some scripture that supports my positions, and then that's what I'll talk about. And so you don't have, like, to some extent, to whatever extent that seminaries and theological institutes impose any kind of academic, let alone moral rigor or integrity on their teachings, the Fellowship Foundation's version of this stuff empowers people who don't have that background, whose only accountability, they talk about this a lot, these accountability groups, it's basically like-minded people who call you out on the stuff that they don't like. There's no systemic approach to ethics or integrity or accountability, right? Real accountability means being open, it means being transparent, and it means being answerable to people you don't like and you don't agree with. And that is something that the Fellowship Foundation does not provide for its members, its associates, or the powerful people that it ministers to and consoles and encourages.
I think Larson's observations apply to Christian nationalism in general. Christian nationalism often operates outside organized Christian denominations. Groups like Family Research Council, Wall Builders, Faith Wins, the Heritage Foundation are all parachurch organizations where there is no ecclesiastical accountability. The articles of faith are rarely about how one gets into heaven, but focuses on public policy goals to achieve political power. There is much Christian rhetoric, but when it comes to the gospel, you could go to all these meetings and read all their materials, but never understand the good news of redemption. It surely appears that the ticket to heaven is despising LGBTQ people, opposing abortion all the time for any reason, opposing gun control, and believing Trump was cheated out of the 2020 election. A good Christian is someone who helps achieve the political goals. If you deviate from those beliefs, your salvation is questionable. Theologian Greg Forster suggests that pastors have been too reticent to counter this extra church political training.
So when the church fails to catechize people to teach them what the Christian religion has to say about issues like justice, then people go find their own teaching and they receive it as religious catechesis. And now the pastors are in a position where they almost can't challenge it because people view it as heresy. Russell Moore's been talking about how he will sit people down and show them stuff in the Bible that contradicts the nationalist stuff that they're preaching. And he says it used to be that they would have difficulty receiving it, but they would in the end say, well, maybe I need to go back and, you know, check my theology. He says increasingly now they just say, well, that the Bible's not my source for politics, right? And these are pastors he's talking about. Right. The pastors have now internalized through the back door this, you know, non-Christian catechesis that we have effectively kind of outsourced.
When you outsource religious training to the Republican Party, don't be surprised if results are skewed in favor of the kingdom of this world. Consistent with political catechism replacing religious training, George Marsden, Nathan Hatch, and Mark Knoll prophesied well of this generation when they wrote in 1983 in their book Search for Christian America, quote, "Perhaps more than ever, a conservative political orthodoxy that includes Christian America themes is a virtual test of the faith in many evangelical, fundamental, Pentecostal, and charismatic churches," end quote. In the religious realm, this may be the saddest consequence of Christian nationalism. Christianity is lost amid the political strategizing and demonization of political opponents. Churches become campaign headquarters, and evangelical is a label for a voting bloc. Eminent historians of American Christianity agree the term evangelical has become a political label. First, George Marsden, then Mark Knoll.
Part of the problem is political loyalties have come to overshadow religious loyalties. And I think that's become far worse in the last 8 years or so than it had been, that's accelerated. And so we have this polarization in the nation, which makes people simply not hear each other. It makes it very hard even to use the term evangelical in the United States. It makes sense as a world phenomenon. There's evangelicalism that's been around and there's certain trace of it. But in the United States, I think because our news is so, maybe everywhere this is the case, is so overwhelmingly dominated by politics that the word evangelical has now become primarily a political label in the minds of an awful lot of people. So it's very difficult to say a person is an evangelical and simply have a purely religious meaning for that, because most people now, when they hear evangelical, they hear conservative or, you know, a certain kind of Republican.
Yeah, I think one of the real, I would call it a tragedy of our day, is that particularly the evangelical label now often is taken to be a statement about political loyalties rather than about an approach to Christian faith. Evangelical historically meant forms of Christianity that hewed close to the gospel of free grace by God's mercy in Christ. If today evangelical means where you stand on social or political issues, that's a real tragedy. Even if it's not as widespread in the local churches as purported, if all that we hear about is the conflation of a religious position and a political position, that's really terrible for the religious position.
I agree. In my experience, people are running away from the evangelical label. Credible surveys show that the number of evangelicals, especially white evangelicals, is dropping. According to the Survey Center on American Life, white Americans who consider themselves evangelical Protestants has declined from 33% in 1999 to 21% in 2021. Minority evangelical percentages have remained consistent. Although many do try to keep politics and religion separate, the reason I produced this series is because a worrisome number do not. And I continue to maintain that fact is not only a problem for Americans historically and politically, but specifically for Christians and Christianity as a faith tradition. If you can give me and my guest a few more minutes, we'll share another reason.
In John chapter 17, Jesus prayed for the unity of the church, that the church would be one as he and the Father were one. And when the church is conflated with the state or merged with the state, it's usually a subgroup of the church that gets government power, money, energy, which often throughout church history has propagated disunity in the church, where you have Christians killing each other, for instance, because of their denominational affiliations, using this apparatus of the state to propagate a certain subset of the church. And one of the things that when the state and the church are merged, it's never with the church, it's with a denomination or a subgroup. And throughout the history, it's created violence, disunion, disunity, fear. One could look at the Reformation and how different city-states behaved with people who were what they would call heretics. And again, how does that impact the witness of the church, not only in one's local community, but around the world? And so if you care about the fidelity of the church, if you care about the unity of the church, and you care about the witness of the church, separation of church and state is good for the church.
Adherents of those who want to turn the clock back have given their earnest reassurances that they do not intend any harm to come to dissenting Christians. George Marsden reminds us that those who sought religious freedom did not give it to others.
For instance, we look at the early Puritans who settled in New England, they were as strongly biblicist in their ideals, and they made as strong an effort to have a Christian government as would be conceivable. It's hardly anything you can think of that they tried. They thought of themselves as the new Israel, and that they would follow God's law and enforce that in the government. And there's a lot of good in that. But their idea was also that therefore you should, for instance, persecute. If someone had been Roman Catholic at the time and shown up in Massachusetts, they would have been thrown in jail. So even though I think the Puritans made a good effort to get along with the Native Americans, nonetheless, the record of warfare and taking their land and so forth, because they thought this was God's will to do it, is far less than ideal. So there are lots of Christian principles being disseminated by the Puritans, but nonetheless, the implementation of that turns out to be far below, the ethics of Jesus.
I don't want to belabor the point, but maybe I do. In many of the online discussions of Christian nationalism, treatment of non-dominant Christian groups comes up frequently. This happens because an accurate understanding of history gives reasonable people many reasons to say that the whole cluster of Christian nationalism ideas have been tried and are harmful. I think it's important to press this point. Christian nationalism requires sinful pride in one's tribe and fragmentation of the church. If implemented, it could again lead to violence. Some Christian nationalist advocates just embrace that. Remember what Baptist William Wolfe said?
I would also like to remind my fellow Baptists that we aren't the shrinking violet in American evangelicalism. We're, millions strong, right? So, I'm pretty confident that if anybody's going to be doing the persecuting, it'll be us.
We check our own ranks. Yeah. Today, yeah.
I assume he would say he was joking. But listen to what isn't a joke. No one has an answer for how they will change what's happened in history. Campbell and Marsden are correct. Every sect thinks it is the true one. Reminds me of something Thomas Jefferson told Benjamin Rush. Jefferson told Rush that despite the First Amendment, some clergy sought a national religion. He wrote in a letter dated September 23, 1800, that his election to the presidency should thwart those aspirations. Quote, "While it secured the freedom of the press, covered also the freedom of religion, had given to the clergy a very favorable hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity through the U.S. And as every sect believes its own form the true one, every one perhaps hoped for its own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. The returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes, and they believe that any position of power confided to me will be exerted in opposition to their schemes, and they believe truly," end quote. James Madison in his memoir wrote, quote, "Torrents of blood have been spilt in the old world by vain attempts of the secular arm to extinguish religious discord by prescribing all differences in religious opinion," end quote. According to Charles Haynes, Roger Williams was at the vanguard of the movement to say enough with religious discord.
People, when they're at the helm, as Roger Williams said to John Cotton, he said, when you were at the helm, you were in the hatches in England, how you cried out against those at the helm, the majority, persecution. Then you get here to New England, and you've forgotten what it was like to be in the hatches. And you're treating people, because you're at the helm, you're treating people as you were treated.
Haynes referred to Williams' book, The Bloody Tenet of Persecution. In it, Williams referred to the helm and the hatches. Let me quote a bit from Williams' book. Quote, "When Mr. Cotton and others have formerly been under the hatches, what sad and true complaints have they abundantly poured forth against persecution? Oh, that the God of heaven might please to tell them how abominable in his eyes are a weight, a stone, in the bag of weights. One weight for themselves when they are under hatches, and another for others when they come to the helm." Williams is a little hard to follow, but focus on that last sentence about the double standard of weights when one is in power, that is, at the helm, and when one is not, that is, under the hatches.
And so that's the incredible challenge for the United States going forward. The religious diversity, and many people with no religious affiliation are part of that diversity, that is America for the future. And so the question in all of this diversity and all of this difference, how are we going to live together across our differences? How is that going to work? And Americans who push to get rid of separation of church and state or weaken the Establishment Clause forget that that is what has made it possible for us to live with our deep differences. I mean, we haven't always been perfect, but imagine if government were able to take sides in religion in any point in our history, much less today, and government were able to promote certain religions and not others. What would America look like? And could we be the country we are, or would we be at each other's throats? And I think if we see around the world where religion dominates, a particular religion dominates in a country in union with the government or in collaboration with the government, persecution results and violence results because people who want to follow their God and their conscience are not going to accept being in a country that treats them as lesser, takes away their fundamental rights to be equal to others because of their religion. They're not going to accept it, and they will fight.
To Christians who want to jump into bed with the state, I pose this paraphrase of the beginning of the third chapter of the letter to the Galatians. After beginning your Christian experience by the cross, will you perfect it with the sword? True, the world is uncertain, but shall the just live by the sword or by faith? Let me end this episode where I plan to start the next one. In her concurring opinion to the Ten Commandments case, ACLU versus McCreary County, Kentucky, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor directed a question to those who want to erode separation of church and state. She wrote, quote, "Those who would renegotiate the boundaries between church and state must therefore answer a difficult question. Why would we trade a system that has served us so well for one that has served others so poorly?" End quote. I am looking forward to completing the series, and I hope you will tune in to the series finale. I am excited to present the thoughts of the experts I've interviewed who answered Justice O'Connor's question. I'm sure you won't be surprised that we all come to an enthusiastic defense of the system which has served us so well. Telling Jefferson Lies is written, produced, and hosted by Warren Throckmorton. For more information about the podcast or the book Getting Jefferson Right, go to gettingjeffersonright.com. Today's closing song is Old Time Religion by the Tuskegee Institute Singers. Telling Jefferson Lies' theme song is The World Awaits Us All by Roman Candle. Background music is provided by Jonathan Swaim, Dustin Blatnick, and Warren Throckmorton. See the show notes for more credits. Please like the podcast and spread the word on social media. Watch for the series finale coming soon, and thanks for listening.
Paul and Silas, it was good for Paul and Silas.